President Obama's inaugural address focused on the many problems facing the nation and called for us to come together to tackle them and put the country on a better course. He brought up protecting the social safety net, protecting equal pay for women and equal rights for gays and lesbians, and the need to deal with the threat of climate change. The economy, gun control, and immigration are at the top of the agenda as the president enters his second term. Joan Walsh joins us now to look at those issues and at the state of the country as President Obama prepares for four more years in office. She's the editor at large at Salon, an MSNBC political analyst, and the author of What's the Matter with White People? Why We Long for a Golden Age That Never Was. It's published by Wiley, and I'm very pleased that she has come back to our show today, although you're in San Francisco.
I am in San Francisco, Leonard. I was with you in person last time. I missed that.
Now, do you think that something like the inauguration feels different on the West Coast because it's just taking place 3 hours earlier?
That we're all in our pajamas watching the speech?
Well, I always feel when I'm there that I'm watching some strange stuff going on in another part of the world.
It is funny. It is a big country, and you really feel that when you're on the West Coast, and you kind of feel, you wake up and you feel like you're a little bit behind. But I definitely got up in time to catch all the pageantry and all the red carpet stuff and just, you know, this great American ritual that we go through every 4 years that is particularly great when your candidate wins, I will admit. But I thought it was just beautiful.
Well, do you think that the mood, not just of the inauguration, but of the country, is less optimistic than it was 4 years ago, although Obama won handily?
No, I think it's more optimistic. And I think, you know, we had a surge in 2009. After the president won, his approval ratings shot up. And, you know, he was much more popular than even the number of votes that he got. And that's happening this time, too. But I think that, you know, the president's speech today recommitted him and recommitted all of us to pursuing equality. I think its inclusiveness was really stunning. I know that, you know, many of your listeners have voted for the same line about Seneca Falls to Selma to Stonewall, but the inclusiveness of that line was really remarkable. And, you know, I don't know that – I know that a speech can't change the minds and hearts of people who are implacably opposed to this president, but I feel in some ways more optimistic than I felt 4 years ago.
Do you think that line will be the ask not line of this speech?
It may be. I think it's going. It's the line that got the most attention. There were several other lines. You know, he talked about this being our moment, and he talked about diversity. I don't know, Leonard, sometimes those of us who care about these issues make diversity sound like it's kind of a drag. It's kind of like eat your spinach. We have to learn to get along, share your toys. But there was a way that the president talked about the diversity of old and young and race and culture that made it about our competitiveness in the world and our capacity to be world leaders because we contain the world. And I don't know that we always hear that from our leaders. We don't hear enough of it from Republicans, for sure. But even Democrats, I think, sometimes talk about it more as obligation than opportunity. And I really like that part of the speech as well.
Your book, What's the Matter with White People, looks at the decline in the power of the middle class, explains why some people believe that this decline is the fault of minorities, immigrants, gay people, and the poor, although I'm never sure how they were specifically responsible. Well, during the presidential campaign, there was a lot of talk about protecting the middle class. Do you think the president will keep that conversation going?
I do. I mean, I think he's talking about protecting the middle class, and I think you're also going to hear more about how we build a middle class and how we build opportunity ladders to let more people in. What I tried so hard to do in the book was show how an earlier generation of Americans made a conscious political decision from FDR forward to build a middle class, that we learned in the Great Depression and also in World War II that we're a stronger country when prosperity is shared. And so we built this middle class that was the envy of the world. And then because of the turmoil of the 60s and a lot of other things, a lot of white working class people in particular helped tear down that opportunity ladder. And I think that all Democrats have been chastened about talking about the poor and know that, you know, middle class people vote, and it's important that we wrap everything we're doing in the cause of the middle class. And I agree with that, but I think it's also time to extend our rhetoric and our conversation about the middle class to people who want to get there and can't get there, as well as people who are falling out. I haven't done the Google search or the Nexus search to see, you know, if he referred to the poor in his last inaugural address, but he talked specifically about the poor, and it's shocking how rarely politicians, even Democratic politicians, talk about the poor. I think this president has been constrained to some extent by concerns about race in being a president who, you know, who wants to rejoin a war on poverty. But I think we're going to see more both talk as well as action.
Well, we have a clip. Do you want to listen to it?
Yes, I do.
The commitments we make to each other through Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, these things do not sap our initiative. They strengthen us. They do not make us a nation of takers. They free us to take the risks that make this country great.
Now, during the election and after, in comments by Bill O'Reilly, Mitt Romney, and others, they made the argument that minorities and poor people voted for Obama because they want things and expect the government to give them those things.
Yes, they did. I mean, I expected him to turn around and look right at Paul Ryan when he made those comments, vice presidential nominee Paul Ryan, because he speaks over and over about the makers versus the takers. And that was the heart of Mitt Romney's horrible comments about the 47% who he can't take personal responsibility for their lives. This was a foundation of the 2012 campaign, and the president was speaking back to people who frame government help with opportunity in terms of turning us into takers. We're, you know, as many of us have said over and over, most of us are takers. We're all, frankly, takers at some point in our lives. And you know, the formula is that we are briefly takers so that we can go on and become makers. And it's a circle of life. And to stigmatize people who need help and not look at the way providing help can make people stronger and put them in the position to give help later, I think that's the part of the formula that's been left out of politics in the last 30 years. And also, you know, I mean, I think the genius of the New Deal and the Great Society, for that matter, was to understand that, yes, we were going to create services and provide education and opportunity to people, and those programs also created jobs, and that there was no shame in that. We built a middle class. You know, some of government employment helped build the middle class, and we started extending that in the Great Society to build a black middle class. And you know, I think that we've turned government workers into welfare queens, and we've stigmatized the service that we can provide one another. And I think the president is pointing in a different direction than maybe he was even 4 years ago.
Well, some people felt that all that talk about the takers was really racial coding. Do you think having a black president has exacerbated racial tensions in this country?
I think it's the Obama paradox. I think we've never been stronger when it comes to a national unity around racial equality, and yet we are also dealing with the president's election did bring out that, you know, I think it's a small minority, but it's a noisy and very frightened and sometimes dangerous minority that is terrified of the fact that this is an increasingly diverse country. I mean, you know, Bill O'Reilly, my good friend, said it on camera election night. You know, traditional America is gone. The white establishment is gone.
He's your good friend.
A lot of people. We had words once on a show. He told me I had blood on my hands, but that's another story. No, he's not my friend at all. But, you know, he felt quite comfortable speaking to Fox viewers and telling them what, you know, some of them already believe, that, that traditional white America is gone. And I think that's very sad, because I think it's sad that any American, Republican or Democrat, who can't look at the future of this country and see themselves in this younger generation, whatever their race, you know, to not recognize that America continues and that the project goes on and gets more interesting because people don't look like you, just seems like seems un-American to me, frankly.
Well, another really polarizing issue is gun control. We have the Attorney General of Texas inviting all responsible New York gun owners to come to Texas, relocate to Texas. I'm sure Mayor Bloomberg would love to see that happen. But gun control,
he's gonna put them on
buses. Gun control suddenly has been at the top of the president's agenda ever since the school shooting in Newtown, Connecticut. His call for universal background checks, banning assault weapons, and strengthening law enforcement. But some on the right, like Rand Paul, have been accusing the president of overstepping his authority. And he even has been talking about the president forcing doctors to amass information on gun-owning patients as part of a mass gun confiscation plan.
And of course he's not doing this, but this is why it's so important that he stood up to the NRA and Wayne LaPierre, because, you know, you remember it was the NRA president LaPierre who talked about jackbooted thugs. The federal agents were jackbooted thugs even after the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995. This tiny minority on the right has used this fear that Obama's coming, or Democrats, not just Obama, Bill Clinton, that they're coming to take your guns, and they speak in these terms of calling him a king and calling him a tyrant, that really serve to, you know, justify, quote, Second Amendment remedies, in the words of Sharon, the dearly departed, politically departed Sharon Angle, the Tea Party candidate for Nevada Senate. I mean, they have wrapped themselves in this, quote, you know, supposed founders' rhetoric about tyranny and about kings to justify not honoring this president, but also just the most vicious kind of opposition. And so it's both scary. It's a little scary to hear the rhetoric that they're using right now, but it's really important that the president is standing up to them because He's. I think he'll pull the American people behind him. You know, opinions are changing on gun control, and there's no way to deny that the horror of Newtown had a lot to do with it. But Democrats chickened out on gun control a long time ago, and now they're realizing that they have to rejoin the battle.
Well, the polls indicate that the public will welcome some tightening of gun control laws, but most of the pundits are suggesting that this thing will drag out and pretty much nothing will be done in the end.
I don't agree with that, but I think there's a risk. I mean, I was...
Isn't that what happened in the past?
It's what happened in the past, and to some extent it's happening now. I mean, you know, some polls are showing a slight decline in support for gun regulation since late December. You know, just in these 3 weeks, some of the urgency has been lost, but there are still large majorities for background checks and banning large capacity ammunition. So I think it's important. I was somebody who was concerned that the president established a task force and gave it to Joe Biden and said, come back to me at the end of January, but they moved much more quickly than I expected that they would. And so I think they know that they have to get some things done quickly or they will lose that moment. I think there's a real sense of urgency about seizing the moment in the second term. And you know, I think the president spent a lot of time, both in his first inaugural address as well as in his first term, really seeing if there was a way to get beyond what he called childish things like, you know, partisanship, and meet his critics and Republicans halfway. And I think, sadly, he learned that he couldn't. And so there's going to be, I think, a tougher line and more effort to rally the American people behind his agenda rather than always looking for ways to help them accomplish theirs. And I think whether the issue is guns or taxes or immigration reform, I think that that's got to be the way to go. He's got to stand up for what he believes in and create a constituency for it, rather than constantly watering down what he wants, hoping to get Republicans on board when they are, you know, they've just said no over and over.
Although he said he wanted people making $250,000 or more to have an increase in taxes, he allowed that to go up to $400,000, and many people see that as a positive sign because much of the Republican Party had drawn a line in the sand and said no tax increases.
Well, in a better world, I was hoping that he would stick to $250,000, but I think people who say that it's important to get any tax rate hikes are right. You know, I'm a progressive, and I think it's my job to push, but I also understand that to get things done, there will be compromise, and I think that compromise was a better compromise than some of the things we saw in the first term. In the first term, we couldn't accomplish that, even that tax hike. It's not the progressive taxation that we need to finance the president's agenda. There's got to be more action on so-called loopholes and making people who make their money off their money rather than off their own labor pay higher taxes. That's got to come. But this was an important first start, and I wrote about this today. I think I was a little bit too critical of Joe Biden's compromise with Mitch McConnell. I think that it was a big deal. It was kind of like breaking the fever and breaking the power of Grover Norquist. I read about this on Salon today. He stood up to the three N's, the NRA, Norquist, and the neocons with his appointment of Chuck Hagel. And those are three forces that have inordinate control over America's destiny and American political agenda. And it's very important that he stood up to people I consider bullies and won battles, if not the war. So I'm liking this tougher president as the second term dawns.
I'm talking with Joan Walsh, an editor-at-large at Salon and an MSNBC political analyst, author of What's the Matter with White People? Why We Long for a Golden Age That Never Was. It's published by Wiley. In his speech, the president called for cooperation. He said, "We cannot mistake absolutism for principle or substitute spectacle for politics." But then in the lead editorial in today's New York Times, they point out that Senator Ted Cruz, just elected by Texans, has already declared war on any calls for compromise.
Well, you know, that's what Ted Cruz believes he was elected to do, and we'll see. You know, Texas is a very complicated place. I do believe it'll be a blue state again in my lifetime. I might have to live a lot longer to see that,
or Austin may have to declare independence.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't believe in secession, but when you look at where the Tea Party is strongest and where people refuse to compromise at all, and where, you know, the gun rhetoric is the most divisive and sometimes dangerous, it is, you know, it is some of the states that seceded, and they've got to make a decision whether they really want to be part of this country. And I have hopes that demographic change will make a difference. But, you know, Ted Cruz is proof that a Latino doesn't necessarily equal liberal. And, Democrats are going to have to fight these battles. There will be people like Ted Cruz. It's not going to be easy. But I think it's important that the president stake out his position and that he didn't automatically cave and listen to Harry Reid, a Democrat who has a high NRA rating, and say, okay, you guys don't want to vote on an assault weapons ban. Okay, we won't do that. He's going to have to compromise, but he's asking for what he thinks is the correct agenda, and I don't think he did that to start his first term. And so I think it's a very positive sign. He has to define what he stands for.
We have just 15 seconds. We mentioned that Sandy Hook was a reason for gun control. Climate change, I guess, wouldn't have come up so prominently except for Hurricane Sandy. But if they have prodded the president to change the way he goes about things, I suspect you think that's a very good idea.
I do.
Okay, well, thank you so much for talking with us today on President Obama's second inauguration day. Joan Walsh is an editor-at-large at Salon and an MSNBC political analyst.